Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. My co-host, Alfred Addisk, will be joining James Corbett today for the second and third segments of today's program, with their usual interview the evening before. So make sure you stay around. I heard it was a great, I didn't have a chance to listen to it, but I heard it was a great, great interview with James Corbett. And let's get started right away with the market report today for December 11th. 2014. And interesting day in the markets. Gold and silver tried to stay up most of the day. Silver was able to eke out a little bit of a gain. You have gold down just change at 1226. We had a high of 1234, a low of 1216. So we're settling right in the center of things at 1226. Silver's up 3 cents today at $17.19. Platinum was up a buck at 1240, along with palladium up 5,822. The USDX today was stronger, 0.45 at 88.68. And crude oil today dipped below that 60 level, 59.75, down 1.19. And this is the first time since July 2009 that the price of oil fell below $60 and ended trading at the 15 or the 59.75. So it has fallen steadily for the past 6 months. It's down 44% since reaching the high for the year in late June at 107. And of course, we all know it's due to the oil production, especially in the U.S. And of course, we know that the global demand has weakened, because of these slowing economies. Oh, in Asia and Europe, but not here in the U.S. Oh, no. Now, everybody's economies are slowing, but right here at home in the U.S. And certainly we're seeing the prices for gasoline drop, and hopefully it goes lower. So you've seen a little bit of those funds coming into, you know, having that little bit more money in their pockets. I guess it makes folks feel a little bit richer. So they're going out and thinking that, well, now I can trade in my car. I can get a new car. And that certainly has been the trend for these past couple of months, where the folks are going out, they're buying more expensive, higher valued automobiles. And a lot of those loans are subprime loans. Again, you know, just like you're beginning to see in the housing market. You're beginning to see 5% down in order to get a new home, and you know, all kinds of tricks and gadgets and manipulations in order to get folks to buy. In fact, I was reading an article today about Germany, how they're about, you know, ready to be in the R word, a recession. And their finance minister comes out and he says, well, the best thing that the German people can do is go out and spend their money. Quit saving it. You don't want to save that money. You know, you don't want to have more than $400 saved up in case of an emergency like those Americans do. You know, spend, get rid of that money. And of course, we heard the same thing after 9/11 when we were, you know, continuing to go into that recession from there. And everybody and their brother was telling the American people to go out and buy. That's exactly what they did, by mortgaging their homes, by, you know, getting all kinds of loans and going into debt. And, of course, we saw one of the biggest expansions in our economy. So, no, you don't. And we have a little article I'm going to talk about, if we get to it, about the cashless society, how these kids are being taught to use their credit cards, their allowances and everything. And it's just like, we're here, folks. Things aren't going to get better. So, but the paper markets today, they had big swings. I saw the Dow was up, you know, over 200 points. I saw it dip all the way to like 75, and then it came back, and we're closing out on the day, the Dow, 63 points. They tried to keep it much higher, but it's up 63 points at 17,596. The NASDAQ was up 24 at 4,708. The S&P up 9. 2031, 10-year yield, 2.18%, up 0.01. Asian markets, Europe markets were, you know, sort of mixed. Not any big swings in any of those overnight. So the big news story, of course, was oil dipping below the $60 level for the first time. And of course, the $1 trillion spending bill, it actually grew overnight. Yeah, it was like 1,603 pages, and overnight it grew to 1,774. How's that work? How's that happen? Well, I think you all know what happens behind closed doors, and trying to change all those nay votes to yay votes. And that certainly was with the Kerry Bentivoglio. I'm sure I mispronounced that, but he's out of Michigan. He switched his vote from nay to yay at the last minute. And there was supposedly Sessions spotted him in the subway, and he told him he said to Bentivoglio that you're a good man, Santa. And certainly, you know, you can get a lot of things coming your way if you hold out to the last minute. And none of those meetings are ever public. And most of the lawmakers had publicly admitted that there was no way they could read the bill before voting on it. So, but I guess Obama saved the day, and he said he would sign the measure, triggering a rare public rebuke from the Nancy Pelosi. She was certainly disappointed. It was a compromise, she says, and it does fulfill some of the many of the top-line priorities that the president himself has long identified. Well, that actually came from the press secretary, Josh Earnest. But so it's, oh, heavens, you wouldn't want any of these people working through their Christmas holiday, would you now? And I guess there was a lot of these, there was some sort of a walkout. Some congressional workers walked out today in support of what's going on with the demonstrations. And I believe they've... it's kind of interesting, because you would think that if you walked off your job, to support a while you're working, a demonstration while you're working, you'd think you'd be fired. Now, they can do it on their own time and on their private time, but I wouldn't think that they should be able to do it on their work time. But anyway, there was one thing in the spending bill that I believe they added at the last minute, or was one of the, and that's about pensions. And you have something that's multi-employer pension. And they could see their benefits cut in this spending deal. And this was all to keep the government running. And so they have a plan here to where, you know, workers could see their plans cut. And what a multi-employer pension plan is, they're usually found in industries that have small employers that would not ordinarily put together a pension plan of their own. And you have about 10 million people that are covered under these plans that involve agreements between the labor unions and a group of companies. And some of these plans cover those who work in construction. You can find it in retail, transportation. And there are about around 1,400 of these pension plans. And so you could see there's about, and some of these plans cover about 1.5 million people. And there's about 10 million people that are covered under these pension plans. But they're saying that about 1.5 million of these people are these people in financial trouble, and these plans could become insolvent within a few years. And of course, this is according to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. The agency, of course, was established by Congress to take over failed and failing pensions when they run out of money. And we do know we have a lot of state pensions that are underfunded and by billions and billions and billions of dollars. And everybody always thought that these, you know, hey, this is an agreement, this is a contract, and these plans would be secure. But with financial crisis that we saw in 2008, it leaves fewer workers to pay into the system. This plan is about $42.4 billion that's short to pay out pensions for plans. And it's up from $8.3 billion in 2013. And you would think that since the stock market up was so high and all these new jobs that are being created and that there was such a boom in jobs that, you know, you wouldn't see it creep up another $8 billion in 1 year. So again, it's another sign that, hey, things aren't as good as they are. Things are not as good as what they tell us. And here's just another sign, another number to prove that they're not as what they say they are. And the kind of cuts that they're looking for, there's some plans that might cut 10%. It might be enough to allow them to survive. But then in other cases, you could see a reduction as high as 30%. So that's certainly, and it's not impossible that some of these cuts could be restored. But again, that depends on the industry, the plan's location, and how much trouble it was when these cuts were actually made. So if 30% is pretty high, highly unlikely that you'd ever restore 30%. Maybe 10, but I don't think that the future of our economy will allow them to restore even 10%. And but these single employer pension plans actually cover up to 31 million. I thought it was 10 million. It's actually 30. Oh, the single employer pension plans cover about 31 million workers and retirees in about 22,000 plans. And these single employer programs, from the PBGC, said earlier this year that it was highly unlikely that these types of pension plans would run out of funds in the next decade. However, we do know there's a lot of these funds that are underfunded. You would, and again, the improving economy, you would think they would have better market returns, and it just doesn't show that that is the case. So again, another sign that legislation is taking over pension plans. It's another sign that your funds and your pension plans are not as secure as you might think they are. And when you have trillions and trillions of dollars that are sitting in these plans, do you really believe they won't touch them? And what do they going to do? They first take out 10%, they first take out 20%, then 30%. And what are people going to do? And it's like, we were able to do that, so let's try some of these single payer plans, these single employer pension plans, and we'll take some of theirs. Let's readjust this. And that's how they get you. They take a little at a time, and people don't notice it, and they don't feel it, but just a little at a time, and it builds until one day they're maybe 50%, 60% taking of your funds. And certainly you have the normal reactions, from the various unions and so forth. But, what are they going to do about it? And, the laws are passed. They're sneaking through these provisions that will affect pension plans. And they do it quickly, behind closed doors. And they really are not there for you. I mentioned that we were going to talk about using with the cashless society. You have more people that are using less cash. They're using their credit cards. People think their money is safe in a bank. They think their money is still an asset, but it isn't. Your assets in the banks are liabilities. And don't think for one moment your money will not be used in a bail-in, just like they did in Cyprus. And families are going from cash to plastic. And even their kids, it amazes me. They put their kids on a weekly allowance that they get on a card instead of cash. Their parents use a mobile app or they go online to transfer money into each child's account. Then you have the children that use their allowance cards to spend their allotments. And it isn't cheap. Think about the cost. Using about $200 billion a year from ATM fees is how much money that these banks from these ATM machines get from the people. And that's a lot of money. And this article is trying to say that this is a good thing, that the American people are actually saving money because they don't pay for the ATM fees. They don't have to pay for, all the little fees that they have when it comes to, maybe pulling out cash and so forth or losing it or, whatever. And they're saying that it's about $1,700 a year per family. But what it really is showing is not teaching kids responsibility. It's teaching them that they can use plastic. It teaches them more about a cashless society. And you kind of lose the grasp between what a card is and what cash is. And it's like here it's given to you instead of working for it. And so again, another sign where society is heading. We all know this, and we know the next steps that come to us. And I think you're going to see more and more people get into trouble. I mean, when you don't have that cash, how many times do you use your ATM machine and you don't mark it down? You just use your card or your debit card. I don't use debit cards. I use cash. Folks lose track of it. And certainly you might have families that are very secure and, dot their I's and cross their T's, but certainly it's very easy to lose track of what you're spending when you're using cards. And the next step, this might be an allowance card. The next step is credit cards. And again, it's the acceptance of debt. It's the acceptance of, spending for things that you don't have. And that's what this country needs. We live on debt. We need that debt in order to survive. And there will come a point in time where that debt is no longer available and many people will lose. We didn't talk about this yesterday. Detroit was formally emerging from bankruptcy, marking the end of the largest municipal case in U.S. history that was supposed to end today at 12:01 a.m. Thursday, early morning. And it's eliminating their budget, $7 billion in city debt. And they must try to reverse decades of population loss by attracting new residents and adding on jobs. They're going to spend about $440 million to eradicate the blight and help demolish more than 40,000 houses that are standing vacant in Detroit neighborhoods. Some $430 million is promised to improve police and fire services and response times to 9/11 calls. And you have a lot of wealthy people that will be benefiting from that $440 million as they went in there and bought up all that property. 800-375-4188. We're heading to break now. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. And hope you enjoy the interview with Alfred Adess and James Corbett.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Are you concerned about prescription drug dependency to stay healthy? Are you worried that the cost and availability of your medications may put your health at risk? Perhaps it's time you consider a natural, safe, and effective way to deal with your health problems. If only you knew where to start. Start right here. Tune in to Herb Talk Live with herbalist Wendy Wilson every Tuesday and Thursday evening, 7 p.m. on AmericanVoiceRadio.com, where your healthcare options just became endless.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis. This is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188. Our guest today is James Corbett from the Corbett Report. You can look this up. Just Google Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report, or you can look for the URL CorbettReport.com. Look for either one of them, and you will find James and some intelligent commentary on what's happening in the world. Mr. Corbett describes the Corbett Report as an outlet for independent critical analysis of politics, society, history, and economics. James, does that mean you don't have any comments on Dancing with the Stars?
Even if I did, I'd keep them to myself. But I must admit, I haven't watched any of those types of programs in many, many years. I can't say that I'm too sad about that.
Well, I haven't seen one in several years myself. I don't actually have a TV anymore. I just get what I get over the internet. And I haven't seen it in several years anyway, but I make fun of it from time to time. Let's start out with the Senate report. Here's something from the Associated Press. harsh CIA tactics didn't work. We are talking about torture. It's much in the news in the last couple of days. According to, who is this, Diane Feinstein, she says the report doesn't call the tactics torture. But Committee Chairman Diane Feinstein, commanding the Senate floor for an extended address, declared that, quote, under any common meaning of the term, CIA detainees were tortured. And they've described it, and I think everyone in the audience, and I imagine you've seen the descriptions of what happened physically. It's really a terrible story. What do you think? Well, what's your first comments on this?
Well, I think we should highlight what I believe the title of that article was pointing at, which is that the program, whatever one might say about it, it actually did not work. And this is something that is brought out in the report, which reveals that despite the fact that the CIA had claimed that some of these torture techniques had helped them to expose various plots, those claims are proven to have been overblown and false. And for example, the claim that this helped to foil some sort of attack that was being planned in the UK to fly hijacked planes into Heathrow Airport and London's Canary Wharf was not brought down by CIA torture tactics, but by British law enforcement agencies doing regular police work. So I mean, again, a lot of this is going to be spun off into a type of debate that I think will be easy for people to wrap their mind around, because the premise of the debate will be, well, torture works and it's good, but, you know, should we do it? Is it morally good? And people will be able to take sides on that debate. But the underlying point is it doesn't work anyway, which should have been obvious to everyone involved since the very beginning. In fact, before the very beginning, because it's self-evident that I could torture you for a few hours or a few days or however long it takes and make you confess to being the Easter Bunny or whatever
the man
I want.
On the grassy knoll.
Exactly.
Maybe, but the
right.
Yes.
You were the one who did it.
I finally admit it. Yeah, finally came clean.
So it is a completely ineffective technique. So whatever else we want to say about it, and obviously, I mean, it is so self-evidently immoral that I really don't know what to say to people who want to say, well, we just have to do it to protect the country, other than to say, well, actually, no, because it literally does not do anything for the protection of the country, even if you thought that would be a convenient justification for this type of abuse.
George Tenet, CIA director, when the 9/11 attacks took place in 2001, he justified that. He said, we know that the program led to the capture of Al-Qaeda leaders and took them off the battlefield, that it prevented mass casualty attacks, and that it saved thousands of American lives. Tenet told the Associated Press the report missed the context in which the harsh interrogations were conducted, with the nation reeling from 9/11 and CIA officials convinced more attacks were coming. The entire government was under pressure to prevent a second wave and lacked intelligence to deal with that possibility. Now, that's true to this extent. People were concerned there was going to be more terrorist attacks. They didn't know where they were coming from, and I can understand why they would react. So we're going to find out if there's more buildings going to be taken down. This is the context for much of the government's mentality and much of the American people's mentality. We're going to do whatever we got to do to protect ourselves. And in retrospect, I understand that. I don't know that that justifies the torture, but I understand this. But the question is, Tenet says we missed the context in which the harsh interrogations were conducted, and that context goes back to 9/11. What is the real context of 9/11? The attacks, were those attacks performed by Muslim terrorists? Or are they just the patsies, kind of like Lee Harvey Oswald, for whatever happened to John F. Kennedy? At least half the country, so far as I know, believes that the 9/11 attacks were probably a false flag attack performed by our own government or elements of our own government. Now, if there was a false flag attack, what? There was only an illusion of justification for torture. What do you think about that? Was that 9/11 a false flag attack perpetrated by our government, or do you think it's rationally attributed to the Muslims?
Well, people who have followed my work since the very, very inception of the Corbett Report will know that I am absolutely a firm believer that the 9/11 official story is a bunch of hogwash, and that ultimately this is a false flag attack. I don't think I would say it was perpetrated by the government, because I think that's too imprecise language to be using, because the government, again, it could include everyone from the president all the way down to park rangers or what have you, and is just such a vague and amorphous term. But there were certainly people, I think, within positions of power in the government who had a responsibility for what happened that day, as well as people outside of the government and in other governments or other intelligence agencies around the world. So I think uncovering, you know, the who, what's, and what whys of 9/11 has been one of the things that I've been dedicated to for several years, and obviously there's a lot of work left to be done on that point. But the idea that it was unproblematically the work of these 19 men with box cutters hijacking these planes, I think, is the most ridiculous of all of the conspiracy theories. So yes, the fundamental justification for this torture, the context which supposedly justified all of it, I think is a bunch of unsupported hogwash. But I think even if we did put it into that context, and even if we did unproblematically accept that the 9/11 Commission report of what happened is the gospel truth about 9/11, I think that the idea that that somehow still justifies this complete, utter upturning and overturning of the most fundamental values supposedly held by the American government and the American people is just ridiculous, is in fact insulting to those generations that fought the Soviets or the Nazis or these other big powers in the past. The idea that a ragtag band of terrorists are somehow going to be able to overturn the fundamental values that these people in the past thought that they were fighting for, at any rate, is insulting to their memory and to the things that previous generations believed. Because ultimately, if the entire fundamental moral fabric of a nation can be completely subverted by just 19 men with box cutters, then really terrorism wins, period. I mean, again, regardless of where that terrorism is coming from, whether it's really from a ragtag band of bearded Muslims or whether it's coming from people in higher positions of power, it's still terrorism, and it still has the effect of causing people to go completely insane and lose their moral fiber. And if that's the case, then that's a sad thing for humanity in general, and I don't think that's something that we should be using as an excuse for what's happened. It should be more an indictment, all the more an indictment of what's happened, and a pause for reflection for any Americans who were caught up in that hysteria in the wake of 9/11, in order to justify things that in any other context would be unjustifiable, unthinkable.
Yeah. You know, you talk about upturning, overturning U.S. values. Did we see an episode where American values were overturned, or did we see an incident, an episode where we got a revelation of what government values really are? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, I certainly do. I think that's a very, very perceptive question. And yes, yeah. I mean, I'm using the idea of upturning of moral values because I think I'm appealing to what I think a lot of people at the very least believed was sort of the fundamental moral fiber of the country. But yeah. I think you're very right. What this has ultimately done is shown, I think, quite demonstrably, that those in positions of power will happily and gladly take whatever the public gives to them in the event of these types of crises in terms of giving them a bit of slack in the rope to allow them to pull society further along towards outright immorality. And I think that that is not just a contingency of these specific set of events with 9/11. I think that is part of the underlying fundamental nature of power itself, and the way that, as the old phrase, Lord Acton's phrase puts it, of course, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Yeah. And we've seen that demonstrated quite sharply over the past decade and a half, if nothing else. And I think this is part of a longer trend. I wouldn't say that, the American government or the public generally were angels before this point. It's just that I think this is really taken it to a sort of breaking point, to the point where I think if you went backwards in time, even 20 years, and showed an American of the mid-1990s what happened in the wake of 9/11, it would be almost unthinkable to that person. I mean, it would look so much like some sort of science fiction movie. And I think for those of us at any rate who were alive during that time and remember something of the mentality pre-9/11, it's good to keep that in our minds, because we can become normalized and habituated to these situations to the point where we don't even really remember that this is something that should be absolutely amazing to us, incredible that this has happened. And I think we need to maintain that sense of incredulity, because we can be normalized into going along with this so easily.
And contrary to our best interest, I mean, each one of us, you know, who knows where your name, you may have a number and be in line for the next available water board. If you're going to allow this to happen, don't be surprised if it happens to you. The problem with it really is that it changes the way we think about ourselves. And perhaps we had a false illusion, but we thought we were the good guys. And I don't think we can look at 9/11. I don't think we can look at Afghanistan. I don't think we can look at Iraq and sit back and say, we're still the good guys. If you look closely, you begin to realize that just isn't so. And that loss of self-image, values that we at least think we have, I think there is great danger in that loss. There was something good about, maybe it was an illusion, but it was a good illusion beforehand, and now we see something else. Let me make the 500-page document released Tuesday included the executive summary and conclusions of a still secret 6,700-page full report. Do you have any idea what we're going to find in the 6,700 pages that we didn't find in the 500 pages?
Well, we'll never know, because they're not going to declassify the 6,700, are they?
I don't know. I mean, the way the story reads, I thought that perhaps it said still secret, but it implies that it would be released. But you may be correct.
My understanding is
maybe
it's only the executive summary that's being released.
Well, it may be. One other point that surprised me is, again, reading from the news report, Senate investigators documented 119 individuals who had been tortured. All right. Now, this is interesting to me, because it's such a relatively small number. It's not like we set up concentration camps of the sort that were attributed to the Nazis during World War II, and this is a handful of people, really. Not one of them is justified. I'm not arguing that, but I am saying there might be a silver lining to this. We tortured 119 people, and the fallout may be so great that based on that sacrifice, whether anybody regards it as a sacrifice or not, but on that loss, that those atrocities, maybe we aren't going to do it again for another 20 or 40 or 50 years. You see what I'm saying?
I do, and I would sincerely like to believe that. I'm not sure that is the case.
I understand. I'm not making a prediction, but I'm saying the CIA, on the one hand, the evidence apparently indicates they didn't get any gain out of this, and they're going to suffer a significant loss. Right, there is going to be a significant price to be paid for having tortured 119 people. And that loss will be international, it'll be national. I mean, no telling how this is going to work out, but it can't work out well. And I'm going to guess that they got their fingers burned so badly that they're not likely to do this again, even if they are. And just, oh, we're not against torture, but it just blew up on our face. It'll blow up again. We don't want to get caught with this thing. We won't get in. Does that make any sense? And we got about 50 seconds before we take another break.
It does make sense. I see what you're saying. There is a precedent that's being set here right now. The only question is which way this precedent works. Does it work against the idea of using torture in the long run, or will it actually, in an insidious way, bolster it? And I think there is a case to be made that this might ultimately actually undergird the normalization of this practice, perhaps not in the way that it's been done in the past, but at least more so, moving the goalpost a little bit closer towards the normalization of torture. So perhaps we can talk about that after the break.
All right, we will talk about the normalization of torture when we return to Financial Survival. I'm Alfred Addis, here with my guest James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in an untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663, or thepowerherbs.com.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Folks, I'm Alfred Addis here on Financial Survival with my guest James Corbett. James is the entrepreneur, mastermind, intellectual behind the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And there's a lot of information. Just spoke in Europe last 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, was invited to speak in Europe on Central Eurasian political policies, and he's building a reputation, increasingly recognized as someone that you want to pay attention to. We were talking about the possibility that torture might be normalized. Right? One of the consequences of this exposure is that maybe torture becomes more normalized. Let's consider that against an article that this is in the Washington Times. The headline is China Torture Report Undercuts U.S. on Rights. And China's official news agency said that the details of the report undercut Washington's standing to accuse other nations of human rights failings. And they also recommended, they said the report would be pointless if it wasn't followed up with prosecutions of those responsible. First question, do you suppose China's exploitation, we could say aversion, but they're probably, they don't have, does China really have an aversion to torture?
Oh, certainly not. No.
Yeah,
no,
I understand.
Certainly not. Not if we look at their justice system, their criminal justice system, in which prisoners are treated in all sorts of different ways, including organ harvesting and all sorts of things like that. And of course, dead Chinese prisoners end up in beauty products for rich British and Americans and other Westerners. So, I mean, that's just I mean, that's just ridiculous.
It's the kettle black.
Exactly. But that's exactly part of the point of this is that this is just an international lowering of the standards. Back in the day, I mean, even if it was never really true that America really was that shining light of liberty and freedom, maybe that was just all rhetoric. But at any rate, it was rhetoric. And as you say, it was a good ideal for people to at least strive to live up to. At this point, what we've had is just an international lowering of the standards so that a China can come back at America and say, yeah, well, you torture as well. So now you can shut your mouths about what we do. And of course, I mean, power structures always love it when they get the opportunity to do that. And I think the other important point of this is that I think that the criticism that the China levels there is correct, that in that they say if there is no prosecution that comes of this, it's all quite meaningless for the U.S. to ever talk about human rights again, because it is important to keep in mind that the only person who has ever been prosecuted, who has been in any way involved with this torture program, is the one who blew the whistle on it, John Kiriakou, who was sentenced for disclosing classified information that linked him to a covert operative back in 2012. But he was the one who originally blew the whistle on the CIA waterboarding program. So there you go. I mean, that's the only justice that has been served in this case so far. And it's very, very unlikely we're going to see any high officials go to jail or even get reprimanded for what went on. And I think that might be the insidious part of the normalization of this, because we can have this big hand-wringing debate as a society or as a civilization even, but ultimately, if nobody gets prosecuted, if there is no consequences for this, then what does that say to people in the future about their ability to break whatever laws, rules, norms, or regulations that society might place on them? It just basically means as long as you maintain power in some sense, then you're never going to be brought to justice for what you do.
What's the reaction of the Japanese people and or the Japanese government, if there's any, you know, divergence? How are they reacting to these reports?
You know, that's an excellent question. I haven't seen any Japanese official response. I'm not sure what the government might be. On the ground in Japan, I think for a long time, there's just been a general sort of sentiment amongst a lot of Japanese, kind of the general, mainstream sentiment. America is just a great place, a place of freedom and all of this. And I don't know if this has really damaged that sort of glossy image. But again, it's almost just like a brand more so than it is an actual thing in the minds, I think, of a lot of Japanese, and not something that particularly preoccupies them. I think for those who are already in favor of this sort of the Japanese-American military relationship and all of that, that's not going to be fundamentally damaged or shaken by this. And for those who are already opposed to it, it's just more fuel for the grindstone? No. I don't know what kind of metaphor I'm trying to go for there, but you know what I mean.
I understand.
Fire, maybe.
Yeah, well, it's one of those things. It's like China sitting back and saying, oh, shame, shame, shame on you. Well, yeah, they're right, but they're also guilty. All right, it'll be exploited. Who's giving us an honest reaction? Is anyone reacting to this honestly? People in Europe, for example, Mexico, South America, is there any part of the world that's taking the news and they're actually giving us an honest and objective response? Or is everybody just using it as best they can to spin it for whatever gain they think they can achieve?
Well, again, I think politicians and power structures are similarly motivated all the way around the world, and they all have their own skeletons in their closet. So, again, they always love to jump on things like this because, again, they can quite rightly talk about the U.S. and point a finger and wag a finger at them, and rightfully so. But, of course, when you're pointing one finger out, you have four pointing back at yourself. So Again, yeah, I think on the political side of it, there's no one who's a spotless angel with a glowing halo of innocence that can lord above the U.S. and talk down to them on this point. I think everyone's miring in the muck, and it's just sort of the average people like yourself and myself and those around us who might have the actual sense to understand what a horrific thing has gone on and be able to talk about it. But we are the type of people who don't have political power and don't seek it. And I think there might be a relation between those two factors.
I think you're probably right. Because when you don't have the political power, and more, you're not even seeking it, then you don't have a vested interest in adopting a particular perspective. You don't have to be a Republican. You don't have to be a Democrat. All you have to be is somebody who actually looks at the news and says, this is what it looks like to me. I don't have an axe to grind, or at least not one that's institutionalized. Let's change subjects a little bit. Prophecy News had an article, How Does It Feel to Be Number Two? For more than half of its lifetime, the United States of America has been considered the leading economic superpower of the world. That's changed recently. According to the IMF, China just surpassed the U.S. in terms of economic output, producing $17.6 trillion of so-called real terms of goods and services, according to MarketWatch.com. As recently as 2000, we produced nearly three times as much as the Chinese. And now they produce a little more than we do. Is this really significant news? I mean, it's significant, but does it point to a dangerous trend? Or when you factor in the Chinese population against the American population and you do the numbers, you add and subtract, whatever, divide, is this really significant that China is now the number one economic power in terms of size?
Lies, damned lies, and statistics. There's about 18 different factors that go into this number. So, for example, I found it particularly funny that MarketWatch.com had an article up talking about this phenomenon, China overtaking the U.S., on the same day that they had an article saying that China did not overtake the U.S. by two different writers, looking at the same data, but coming to two vastly different conclusions, because there is comparisons that you can do between purchasing power versus GDP measured in U.S. dollars. You have to take into account per capita, things like this. So there's a lot of different ways to look at it. For example, if you look at dollar-denominated GDP, the U.S. still makes up 22% of the world total of GDP, all combined. The Eurozone at 17%, China at 11%. So by that, the U.S. is double. But if you look at purchasing power, you get a different picture. So there's a lot of different kind of nuances to this. But I think the underlying point is the trend. And the trend is obviously growing Chinese share of global markets. And that is significant. I mean, that's not just a statistical, sleight of hand. That is something that's really taking place. The question, of course, is what's underlying that. And for the last several years, as we've talked about before, it has been a lot of stimulus and credit that's being created in the Chinese banking system that doesn't really reflect any fundamental underlying growth in the Chinese industrial capacity or power, or at least not as much as what was taking place in the past decade. So there's definitely been a slowdown in terms of the growth of the Chinese economy, but not in terms of the growth of the Chinese credit and money supply, which is, I think, what's fueling Chinese growth at this point. So the question is, can China maintain that trend? Is this just the trend that's going to taper off? Is China going to hit a brick wall in terms of the piper stopping the tune and the bill coming due for all of the stimulus that they've been throwing around? Or will they be able to continue that trend? Will the U.S. start to unwind now that the stimulus, the quantitative easing insanity stimulus is over, and now they're talking about raising interest rates? Is that going to bring that particular stage of this so-called recovery to an end? There's so many different factors here, but one that I think is fundamental and really, really interesting at the moment is, of course, what's happening in the oil price right now as we see it plummeting. I think now Brent crude somewhere around $60 a barrel.
Yeah,
something
got down.
Heading
It got down to $60.90-some, and then it came back up in the aftermarket. But it was right down below $61 earlier today.
And according to, I believe, Bank of America, heading down towards $50. And that is a very interesting turn, because that starts to shake out some of the huge gains that we'd seen in recent years that had been a result of this shale revolution, the shale oil and gas. And now we're starting to see perhaps some of those producers being shaken out of the market by these extremely low prices, which might unwind some of the incredible boom in supply we've seen in recent years. But then that also will drive down liquefied natural gas prices, making LNG more of a sort of tantalizing import for places like Europe, so they don't have to rely so much on Russian pipelines. I mean, this changes the game in so many different ways, and this seems to be part of a longer-term trend that we're looking at here. So, I mean, there's geopolitical ramifications to this. There's economic ramifications. We are facing the specter that this is not just manipulation in terms of Saudi Arabia pumping as much as they can, although that's obviously going on. But this might also be related to commodity prices dropping across the board, which might be a part of a deflationary depression trend that's taking place now that the easy U.S. liquidity funny money is coming to an end. We've seen the inflationary, where it hasn't really come out in the economy as inflationary, just in the stock market. But now that that funny money is drying up, even that's going to come to an end. Will that crash the stock markets, which have obviously been overinflated for a number of years now? I mean, so many different things going on right now that I think, rather than the China-U.S. horse race, I mean, I think this brings in sort of the global economic picture and really the bigger question of whether or not, not only whether or not this current system can be maintained, but really for how long. I think that's really the question that we're all wondering.
I think one of the questions that crosses my mind is, will Saudi Arabia loosen up, ease up on this attempt to drive the price down in the near future? Next month, 2 months, quarter? Or is this a long-term attempt to effectively assassinate and destroy the shale oil industry in this country? In other words, they're not just going to try to spank the United States and say, oh, you're selling shale oil and we don't like it, then we'll let you off the hook. Is this going to be sustained long enough to put the shale industry out of business?
You know, this is really interesting, because this brings up the underlying motivation for Saudi Arabia in doing what they're doing. And I think there are at least three different ones that we can pinpoint. I mean, one of them that you say is this, at any rate, whether it's intended or not, will shake out some of those shale oil producers. Oh, yeah. And will affect the shale revolution that's taking place, potentially, if it is sustained long enough, maybe shake them out completely. And so that's obviously, that could be one motivation for Saudi Arabia in doing this, to get rid of some of that competition. But one thing that's been talked about elsewhere is that ultimately the overproduction from Saudi Arabia was part of a secret deal between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia, where the U.S. agreed to help out in Syria, basically bombing Saudi Arabia's enemies in return for, we'll help you shake out some of your basically State Department targets, Russia, Venezuela, Iran, some other countries that rely heavily on oil exports. And in fact, Venezuela is now definitely feeling the pinch of these lower oil prices, a country that I believe, off the top of my head, something like 95% of their import revenues come from, basically international revenues come from oil exports, and something like 80% of their consumer goods are imported. So that's a huge hit to the Venezuelan economy. And of course we're seeing that now with Venezuelan bonds basically just the market going haywire, and the possibility of a Venezuelan default as early as next year. I mean, that's some pretty huge effects that are already happening. And of course Russia is feeling the squeeze, and we're seeing some pretty major moves in the Russian economy as well.
I tell you what, so James, I'm also feeling the squeeze.
No.
Because we are out of time.
We'll
have to talk more next Thursday. Next Wednesday night, we'll talk more on what's happening to Russia, Venezuela, the global economy. This oil is significant. It's not just a minor event. This is real. This is big time news, although it's not clear what's happening. This is something to watch. I want to thank all of you people for listening. I'm Alfred Addisk. My guest is James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. Talk to James a week from now. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, James, and Frank, the producer. Good night.
All night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.